Welcome to Indie Film Weekly, a No Film School podcast. I'm Liz Nord, editor-in-chief of No Film School.
And I'm Ryan Koo, founder of No Film School.
It's May 5th, 2016, Cinco de Mayo. On this week's show, there's a whole lot of news in the online video space, some controversy at Hot Docs, and after two special episodes, we're back to bringing you our regular features, gear news, grant and opportunity deadlines, movie releases, and our newest segment, Ask No Film School.
So as usual, we are recording this in downtown Brooklyn, New York. As Liz mentioned, back from a couple of special episodes, one on NAB, one on Tribeca. And we're just here to bring you the things that you might have missed while you were working on film projects or while we might have been working on these other special episodes. If you haven't seen our Lytro video at No Film School, we released that shortly after our last episode of Indie Film Weekly. And I'm happy to say it just hit 100,000 views. So it's very much of interest. We will talk a little bit more about that later in the podcast. But for now, let's get into it.
What Ryan means to say is if you haven't seen our Lytro camera post yet, then you are in the clear minority and you better get on that.
Well, thankfully, we have more than 100,000 readers. So actually, anyway.
Anyway, one of the tech announcements this last week that is not specifically gear related, but is techy, is that VHX and Vimeo have merged. So Vimeo announced that they've acquired the online video monetization and distribution platform that many of us have gotten to know over the years as an indie-friendly distribution platform.
So VHX, for those who don't know, was a truly indie direct-to-fan distribution platform. It was launched by founders Jamie and Casey after they had helped Aziz Ansari sell his comedy special in 2012, following on the heels of Louis C.K., who had done the same thing by selling basically a video file direct to fans, but they needed credit card processing, account creation, you know, a web presence in general. And so Jamie and Casey turned that into a platform for filmmakers to not only sell movies, but also to just to run a general film website.
And it's worth mentioning, by the way, that Jamie and Casey themselves aren't just tech guys. They are filmmakers and film creators. They did one of my favorite kind of film interactive projects in the past couple of years, Star Wars Uncut.
Which is great. Check it out if you haven't seen it. It's a lot of fun. So then Vimeo also launched a similar Vimeo On Demand service, which allowed filmmakers to sell typically features for a filmmaker set price direct to the fan. And both of these platforms would allow the filmmaker to keep the vast majority of the proceeds, between 85 and 90%. To me, the problem with the direct-to-fan revolution, or where it has stalled out, is not a matter of the percentage of how much you get to keep. If you're selling 12 copies of your movie, you don't particularly care whether it's 70% or 90%. The challenge in this space is not the actual distribution of a digital file. That's kind of the easy part to take care of. It's the marketing. It's getting people to care about your movie and getting the word out. And so with this consolidation of services, I see it potentially as a good thing.
I mean, it seems as though VHX saw something valuable in the audience numbers that Vimeo has, and Vimeo saw something valuable in the technology that VHX could provide.
Yeah, I mean, certainly VHX, really smart from a technology standpoint. I think Vimeo is looking to build out their feature set there. To me, the merger is really about two things: apps and credit cards. Most people are not going to their laptop or their desktop computer in search of a movie to watch. They're watching their movies on their TV, their projector, their tablet, their phone. It's already on their devices. And considering a lot of these people are looking at something like an Apple TV and browsing there, the indies are getting short shrift because you're just not there. It's like iTunes is there, Hulu is there, Netflix is there. So just having the capability to sell directly to somebody does not mean that anyone's actually going to be there looking to buy it. And VHX had announced that they were close to launching their Apple TV app. Vimeo has their own apps on a few different platforms, but the consolidation of those two things could create, you know, more traffic, a higher number of customers that could be potentially browsing for your content on the platforms where they're looking to watch movies. Casey actually said on the Vimeo post that the two services are going to continue existing separately for the foreseeable future. I imagine that there's going to be a lot of data sharing and technology built out behind the scenes, and we'll have these guys on the podcast, hopefully, to discuss it. The other reason I mentioned was credit cards, and that is the whole app revolution The reason that iTunes is so popular, the reason that Amazon Prime works, is that if somebody already has your credit card stored, they are going to be able to drive sales much greater than your own website, which would require someone who's going to spend $3 to rent your movie to go find their credit card and put in their info and fill out a form and have a new account created. It just doesn't make sense. So by consolidating, they're potentially aggregating more credit card numbers with the central database, just like iTunes or one of these other behemoths of distribution. So hopefully that can help, because no one wants to go type in that number one more time. I've been following this direct-to-fan space for a long time. I actually wrote a piece for the print version of Filmmaker Magazine a while back about Google TV and how excited I was about its potential. And I turned out to be just horribly, terribly wrong.
Wah, wah.
Because nobody bought that thing. But I think the idea was sound, which is that if there is a universal search function where you are watching movies digitally, and the newest version of Apple TV has this, Roku has it, it's like an agnostic search box. So if you were to search for the title of your movie, most of these places, it wouldn't come up at all. Someone, even if you had a demand generated for your movie, they wouldn't be able to find it because they have to go into the individual service. They have to go into Netflix and search. They have to go into Hulu and search. They have to go into iTunes and search. Whereas when you back that up and make a universal search box, something like a VHX app or a Vimeo app could make it just as easy to watch as a major studio picture. So hopefully, as these services get consolidated and more appified, that it will be a good thing for indies.
I think it's exciting. Yeah. I mean, I have Apple TV. I just got the newest one, and that sort of universal search hasn't been working that well for me, or at least not in the way that I expect it to work. I think it probably works well for Apple in that it always surfaces the iTunes material first.
Interesting. I have the previous one.
But what you're saying in theory really makes sense. And it's always a challenge for indies to get eyeballs. Even if you get a theatrical release, the biggest challenge is getting people to know about it and getting people there. So I don't think this is like a new challenge on the internet. It's just that there's more stuff out there to compete with. So in the vein of more stuff online to compete with, there's also more curation and more networks and big brands getting involved in surfacing great online content, to the point where if you've worked in TV, you might be familiar with Upfronts, which is this big event every year where TV programmers and networks will kind of pimp their wares, will show off the latest upcoming seasons to advertisers. And there's, you know, these big swank events. And just a few years ago in 2012, a sort of new version of that started called Newfronts, which is sort of like the online equivalent. So online platforms, online brands will pimp or will, you know, show off their content to advertisers. And this means a lot of different things. One thing it means is that online content really is now a big, serious, you know, money player. It's not just, you know, people messing around and seeing if it's going to stick. Like, online video is here to stay, because even to get a slot in these Newfronts presentations, the companies have to spend tens of thousands of dollars. On that note, originally, these were just for content from the really big names like YouTube and at that time Yahoo and AOL. And now some of the more niche brands that feature a lot of indie work are sort of playing in that same field. So, for example, this year, Refinery 29, which is, if you're unfamiliar with it, is kind of a women-focused online network, brand, content space. I don't know what you call these things these days.
They just launched a VR studio, right? So they're kind of like everything now.
Yeah. These online companies are media companies, just
BuzzFeed,
like any others, basically.
Motion Picture Studio.
Yeah. And BuzzFeed also had Newfronts, like presented at Newfronts this year. So Refinery 29 had their sort of biggest showing yet. As Ryan mentioned, they launched a VR studio. They have a couple new YouTube channels. And I think of particular note to indie filmmakers, they've started a kind of anthology film series. And they're not calling this like a web series. They're not calling it online content. They're calling it a series of short original films. In this case, because of the nature of Refinery 29, they're written and helmed by female directors. And it has like some big indie names behind it, like a Sundance Women Institute, or is that what it's called? Women at Sundance, something like that.
Well, how would I know?
I don't know.
I wasn't invited.
Oh, maybe next year, Ryan. Anyway, and you know, names we're all familiar with, like Christine Vachon from Killer Films. And I think it's going to be a really interesting series. So there's a couple big actress names that are making their directorial debut in the series, like Kristen Stewart and Gabourey Sidibe, but also several indie, like real indie directors are part of this this group, like Jessica Sanders. She made After Innocence, which was like on Academy Award shortlist, and has also made a short that was a nominee. And Roja Gashtili, who is another doc maker who got her start working with Alex Gibney. So it's, I think that's something to look out for, both as fans, but also as makers, that this, you know, is a potential opportunity for us to keep looking in this online space as more and more money is getting put there and more sort of credibility is placed behind these things.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking just previously about all of the challenges of sort of doing it yourself in terms of distribution. But at the same time, as you mentioned, there's so much more content out there. There are also so many more platforms, and just the rising number of opportunities, whether or not these platforms are around for the long term and people are going to watch the content, at least there's so many more online outlets, even cable TV shows, it's all at an all-time high. So at least the opportunity to make something for somebody else, at least, is rising.
Yeah, I'm reminded of this little interview that I posted during South by Southwest after a panel about like digital content creation. And this producer, Kesla Childers, was talking about how basically filmmakers today are content creators, and I understand why this sentiment got a lot of sort of like negative feedback from filmmakers and from our readers. But Kesla really pushed back and said, basically, like, would you rather make an art house film that maybe five people see if it ever gets, you know, into a theater, or make a movie that is shown online to potentially tens of thousands or millions of people? I mean, it's a compelling question.
Well, I answered that question myself since I'm making my feature amateur for Netflix.
If you're interested in playing in this space and kind of figuring out where your work fits in best, you could potentially be actually following all of these New Fronts presentations that all the different platforms are making. So basically getting a sense of who's doing what, who's pitching what, who's putting what out there, so that you might know where to direct your own work toward. And actually, Ad Age is live blogging these things. They're going on through May 13th. So if you go to the Ad Age website, you can kind of follow what, you know, what's being put out there right now. One of the directors included in this Refinery 29 film anthology series is actually one of my mentors, Tiffany Schlein, who has had four films at Sundance. Three of them were shorts. The most recent was a feature called Connected. And she's such a dynamo. She also was a founder of the Webby Awards. So,
speaking of which,
dun, dun, dun.
Let's talk about the Webbies. They announced their winners this week. And then they're going to have a ceremony coming up. What have you seen there, Liz?
Well, it's funny because the ceremony itself is on May 17th. So it's unusual that they like for award ceremonies to announce the winners first. But the thing that's cool about it is that then you can go, like we can all go online now and watch all the winners in advance of the ceremony, which, by the way, is always really fun. It's like a fun ceremony. I mean, it's being hosted by the comedian Nick Offerman, who people might know from Parks and Recreation, the mustache guy. And also, the acceptance speeches are only 6 words long.
Did they extend that? Because it used to be 5 words. Like, it was 5 words when I won. I only got 5 words.
Anyhow, they're short speeches, which is good because there's like a billion categories. But there's over 50 categories just in online film and video. So you can go online now to the Webby Awards site and start checking them out. You had asked me what I liked. I didn't see everything. I mean, you could spend hours and hours and hours like just getting lost in this rabbit hole. But I will say, in my own personal They Were Robbed category, I was kind of surprised to see that in the documentary individual episode category, Call Me Caitlin, which was Vanity Fair's doc about Caitlyn Jenner, beat out Chris Milk's Clouds Over Cedra, which we've brought up Clouds Over Cedra on the show this year. It was one of the most talked about short documentaries of the year, not only because it was shot in VR, but because it was such an impactful use of VR. It was this beautiful piece from the perspective of a little girl in a Syrian refugee camp. Like, people are figuring out how to use VR as more than a gimmick. And this was a really great example. So I was kind of sad to see that it lost.
And what did it, that was the People's Choice Award, or that was the Webby winner itself?
The Webby winner.
That's too bad, because usually, you know, the People's Choice Awards at the Webbys are just that. It's a straight popularity contest with the most number of votes winning the People's Choice Award. But the Webby winners themselves are done by a qualified jury. So hopefully, even if you're not as well known as something like, you know, the whole Caitlyn Jenner thing, which is tied into massive reality TV exposure and a lot more people know about that, hopefully then the smaller projects can win, which was how my own web series in 2008 was able to win, because we were up against, you know, a series that had 150 million views. So the Webbys every year, it's a great chance to go online to their site, look at the winners, and try to catch up on maybe the things that you missed over the course of the year, some of the best examples of online video. But I was shocked to know that there are now 50 film and video categories, because when we were able to win the Webby for best drama, there were really only a few categories at the time. This was 2008. I think it was the second year there was any film and video recognition at the Webby Awards. And of course, you know, as winners of an award, we definitely faced less stiff competition back then. Maybe there were like five nominees and there might have only been five dramas online that year, for all I know, period. So, you know, we were better than four others, maybe, I guess, in their eyes.
Congratulations.
I'm sure it's much, much harder to win this year. But I did want to bring this up, not to pick a bone with your mentor. The secret with the Webby Awards, and the reason there are so many categories, is that the application fee is so high. Why does that not make sense?
If the application's fee is high, wouldn't you have less people applying?
No, because the problem with the Webbys is they've gotten so corporate that a corporation is going to pay, the application fees are between like $200 and $600 to apply for something. This is not like a film festival. So automatically you have large corporations and agencies who have spent potentially millions on a project, of course, applying. Whereas for Zach Lieberman and I, who spent sometimes that amount of money on an entire episode of our web series, to even apply was a big decision.
So nobody gets nominated for Webbys. You actually apply. How does it work?
That could have changed. I don't know. I mean, it was 2008 when we won. But yeah, it was a big decision for us, because we did our entire web series for a few thousand dollars. And here we are like, you know, if we win this award, if we get nominated, you know, what would it do for our show? Is it worth it to spend the money? And so on and so forth. And we never had an expectation that we would even be nominated, much less that we would win best drama. But so there's been a lot of category inflation, because, of course, people have more of a sense that they're going to win an award if they're up against best real estate website, if they're up against specific other categories, as opposed to best website. So the awards can run pretty long, and actually the film and video awards are separate from the main Webbys, and we went to both. They were both a lot of fun. You meet a lot of great people. Stephen Colbert gave the best Webby speech, the best five-word Webby speech that I saw that year, which was, me, 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 me. But it's a really fun award show. I think it's really important. The New York Times has called it the Oscars of the internet. But there is this element of, from the indie perspective, of saying, hey, wait a second. If the application fee is that high, then a lot of people just aren't going to apply that are really, truly indies.
Absolutely. I actually had no idea. Is that true of the People's Voice Awards, too? You have to actually...
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you haven't been
running.
Yeah, because the nominees are selected from the people who applied. So it's this much larger pool of applications that then is narrowed down to the nominees, which generate a lot of traffic for voting. And then the juries pick the winners. So there are some other online video awards also to be aware of in that light. I think the Streamy Awards is specifically for series. Short of the Week, one of our favorite websites, they have their own awards. And there used to be the Vimeo Festival and Awards, and that hasn't happened in a couple of years.
That was so fun. I actually really miss it. They always had this amazing party.
When we get some of the Vimeo people on our podcast, we'll ask them about the plans there, because that was a great example of a good time to be had offline about the online space.
And Streamy Awards, huh? That sounds somehow dirty.
Hot Docs sounds like it could be dirty too, actually.
Oh my God, Hot Docs, you're right. Boy, so this is our raciest episode yet. Anyway, so Hot Docs is going on right now. We are not there on the ground, but still talking about it, of course, being Indie Film Weekly, not just in New York. It's actually the Canadian International Documentary Festival. It's going on through May 8th. And if you're not familiar with it, it's the largest documentary festival and I think only documentary-specific market in North America. So this year alone, there are 232 films in the festival. So it's, you know, pretty comprehensive. And certainly for doc people like me, it's a destination festival. It's a place you really want to be shown. One of the films this year is experiencing a controversy kind of similar to one we covered a few weeks ago, the shakeup around the documentary Vaxxed from Tribeca, which was ultimately pulled from the Tribeca lineup. In this situation, kind of ironically titled The Opposition, the filmmaker's name is Holly Pfeiffer. It's a film about the fight to stop the development of a five-star resort in Papua New Guinea, which, if built, would raise several people's homes. One of the activists profiled in the film, who had some dramatic footage in the film where she was really standing up physically against bulldozers, from this company, has since switched sides and has been hired by the development company to help with the relocation of the residents, on behalf of this development being built. And so, as part of that process, the development company has gotten behind her to sue the filmmakers to, first of all, remove her parts from the film and also just, like, squash the film altogether.
So it was the threat of the lawsuit. Like, I'm sure they had the release form signed and everything for her to be in place, but monetarily, it was the potential threat of the lawsuit that made them change it leading up to the screening?
I mean, it's not a threat of a lawsuit. The lawsuit's happening. So while there's a court action, they couldn't do anything with the film, basically. So they had two choices. One was to wait until the lawsuit's, finished and something's decided. And then, maybe if it's in their favor, they could show the film. Maybe that would be a couple of years. Who knows? The other choice was to edit the film, according to, the kind of stipulations going on in the lawsuit. And so that's what they decided to do. The production team worked around the clock for 9 days. They had 9 days between when the lawsuit was started and the festival was to start. And they re-edited the entire film, basically cutting out this woman, or, the filmmakers are calling it a redacted version of the film. So it's screening in Toronto, but it's screening as a redacted version. And, as a doc person, obviously this gives me a lot to think about. I don't know, Ryan, what do you think you would do in that situation?
I'm surprised we don't hear more about this, because there are so many documentaries made that feature somebody in it that then later decides they don't like their portrayal or they've had a change of heart. And if the way to shut that down is simply to participate in our overly litigious culture and just start a lawsuit, I'm surprised that's not a more commonly employed tactic.
As a doc filmmaker, it's the one of the scariest things that could happen. It's the biggest risk. I think about it all the time, and I've had it happen in shorter circumstances, not going as far as a lawsuit, but someone saying, I don't want to participate, or I don't want to see, people to see this. And you have to decide whether, you're willing to, what's the ethical choice, when other people's lives are at stake. But I think you're right. I don't think we don't hear about it because it doesn't happen. I think we just don't hear about it because maybe these films never got to the point of having a Hot Docs, for example, interested, because this happens, among my circle of documentary people, this happens frequently. Like, you wouldn't believe how many lawsuits that documentary filmmakers are fighting. And maybe you also don't hear about it because they're still moving forward with the films and they don't put the legal stuff publicly, but it's so common. So, I admire the filmmakers for sort of pushing forward, but I also really feel sorry for them because they're not showing the film they want to show.
Absolutely. And of course, when there's pending legal action. You can't talk about it publicly usually, so that maybe that's just the reason why, I guess.
I mean, I don't know how things work in Canada, but anyway, so that's just one of the 232 films this year at Hot Docs. Another one that we want to give a special shout out to is called La Laguna, and it was edited by a friend of the No Film School family, Johnny Bassett, and directed by Aaron Schock. This film is about a Mayan boy raised in a traditional family in the jungle, and when he comes of age, he has to leave the jungle and leave his family and earn a living in Mexico City, obviously a big culture shock. And it's one of those films with an interesting story behind the story, because the director, Aaron, originally intended to make a movie about the rural education system in Mexico, but then he met this boy, Jose, who's the protagonist of the film. He earned his trust, and he ended up following the boy and his brother actually back into the jungle and shooting there for months. And he, you know, from what I understand, just got unprecedented access. I mean, I've seen a lot of docs, and I've never seen one from a modern day, you know, Mayan jungle, like deep in the jungle kind of traditional family. So it sounds really, really interesting.
So if you want to get in on the documentary action going on at Hot Docs, even if you're not there, you're not in Canada, they have a really cool feature on their site that links to streams of past festival films and grantees. And that site is?
hotdocs.ca.
Every week on Indie Film Weekly, we do a wrap up of some gear related stories or technology tool related stories. We're just wrapping up our coverage of NAB at No Film School. So if we were to cover all the ones that we've covered, there would be 100 talking points here. We are not quite at 100 videos, but I think by the time we post the next several, we'll be there. And we talked about NAB a lot on this podcast. Micah Van Hove and I did an entire episode from Vegas. So if you're interested in hearing a wrap up of NAB, I think that's a couple episodes ago on this podcast feed. The one thing about that podcast was we recorded it before I went the next day to do this in-depth demo with Lytro that I mentioned earlier on the podcast. We had to do some editing. It was quite an in-depth demo with a lot of assets and recorded it under some trying circumstances. You know, when you're recording 100 videos in 3 days, you don't necessarily have your druthers about the equipment that you have handy, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, you guys were beasts.
I didn't think we were going to do that many, but hopefully we've been able to sort of bring the experience of what it's like to go to Las Vegas and get your hands on the gear and see what you might be able to use on your own projects to people worldwide, which is the purpose of our NAB coverage. Me personally, going to NAB is not just to represent No Film School and to interview people and to see things to share with the world, but it's also, as a filmmaker, I'm interested in what can I use on my film. And in the case of Amateur, the film I'm about to make for Netflix, it's a basketball movie. Basketball and most sports films in general have traditionally been filmed from the sidelines with really long lenses. Cameras used to be a lot heavier than they are now. So I'm going there as a filmmaker interested in what I can find creatively that can allow me to achieve the look that I want to achieve, which is a bit different from what we've seen before. And that's always the point of going to Vegas. It's never to say, oh, look at this great new thing that I can't use, or like, isn't this manufacturer amazing because they won the spec sheet war. So I saw a lot of things that I'm interested in testing. And so for me, NAB was a success for that reason. However, NAB was also a success because we did get this exclusive demo from Lytro that we put out a week ago today. And it has over 100,000 views now, and it's great to sit there and invest more heavily in a piece that we think is going to be really interesting, and then to see the filmmaking community respond in kind with that interest.
Yeah, and just so you guys realize, if you haven't seen our massive list of NAB videos, most of them are quick, kind of, okay, we're on the showroom floor, here's this piece of equipment, you know, check it out, here are a few features. Like, essentially a bullet point, like a video version of bullet points. But this Lytro demo is a full-on 25-minute, you know, you haven't seen it anywhere else, in-depth exploration of this major development in the camera world.
And that was what we wanted to do because, of course, general entertainment publications don't have the audience that's going to understand the implications and how these things work. Whereas at No Film School, we have a lot of cinematographers, we have a lot of post-production people, below-the-line people in general, so we could go more in-depth and engage the audience in that. And the Lytro, if you haven't seen it, it's a 755 megapixel cinema camera. And that's the least interesting thing about it. Like, the fact that they developed the highest resolution video sensor in history is, like, not the headline feature. The headline feature is that, as John Carafin, the head of Lightfield Video at Lytro, explained in his demo to me, is that it captures a digital holographic representation of what's in front of the camera. So it's basically like taking a scene and adding depth info to it and turning your video into almost more of like a CGI rendering of the live scene and allowing you to manipulate everything in post. So check that out if you haven't seen it. The interesting thing about that was to be talking about the future of cinematography in a way that this isn't going to have a short-term effect. You know, this is something that it's the size of our podcast booth. It's a huge camera. It's going to be really expensive, huge amounts of data, but it could potentially migrate its way down to indies eventually. John mentioned that they are trying to get it down to the size of a traditional cinema camera.
Wow.
The interesting thing about it was to go in there and film it in these NAB circumstances. Normally, this would be something where you would go and you would light it, and you would have a slider and tripods and lavalier mics on both speakers. We were filming our NAB videos on the convention center floor when this opportunity came about. So I had to just steal a cameraman from one of our other on-camera people, walk across the parking lot in 90 degrees, sit down with no prep, and just do this interview. And then I had one of our editors, Jared, cut until 2:30 that morning. He was quite hopped up on caffeine, to get it from 45 minutes down to 35 minutes. And then we got back to New York, and then I cut on it some more, got it down to 25 minutes. We did a lot of reordering of it so that it would make sense. John's presentation was great, but he's a genius, and sometimes it goes over your head if you're not up to speed on things. So we did some reordering. And the interesting thing about releasing it was, you know, we had a handheld camera. We had another camera that wasn't on a tripod, so we set it on a table. And the Lytro computer nearby, it's doing so much work because the amount of data it's pushing and the rendering that he was doing, it was a real-time demo. You know, the it's not like a canned presentation. When he's making a change, he's showing it to us. So that computer started screaming by the end. It just had heated up. The fans were ramping up. The whole room was loud. The computer was on the other side of the room, and yet it was ruining our audio. And we didn't have lavalier mics. We had our little reporter mics from the floor. So, of course, we go in there, and we've got handheld, no tripods, no lavs. We cleaned it up as absolutely best we could. John Fusco, our producer of this podcast, did some serious audio editing to try to get rid of this background sound, and then the computer fans changed, so your background noise is now a different pitch, and it's even louder, and you know the noise reduction is serious on that. And then I went in and stabilized some of the shots. And I'm used to using Adobe's Warp Stabilizer in After Effects. In this case, we were trying to fast track it, so I did it in Premiere. And it does some weird tracking thing where it's actually tracking John's face instead of the background, so the stabilization looks a little bit strange. So it's really weird to be putting out this video that we made in these circumstances, which is about the future of cinematography and all the things that are going to change potentially, where like we didn't have the basic assets that we would want to capture this properly.
It's all very meta. I mean, certainly these videos from NAB aren't up there to showcase our skills as filmmakers. They're to show you what's happening with these products. And in this case, first of all, in watching that video, Ryan, I think just like any of us who make stuff, you probably feel, you know, you notice some of these things more than we did. I didn't notice anything off about the stabilization, blah, blah, blah. When I watched it, what I noticed was, oh my God, this Lytro camera, like it looks unreal. I can't believe what it can do. And I actually didn't really believe it until I saw the demo. And, you know, we've discussed some of the drawbacks of, you know, potential drawbacks of the camera on other episodes and in our own posts. But just watching the demo is so fascinating. Even if you're not a camera person, you kind of have to see it to believe it. I highly recommend checking out this video.
Sorry for the bad stabilization and sound. I'm a perfectionist. What can I say?
Oh my God. Sorry, not sorry. Hashtag sorry, not sorry. Point is, if you're not out there making work, you're not going to make mistakes. You know, if you are out there making work, you are going to make mistakes. That's part of the beauty of this process. And to help enable you to do so, there are grants and opportunities available. So on May 8th, just a couple of days, there's a deadline for a new documentary grant, the Miller Packin, I believe it's pronounced, Miller Packin Documentary Film Fund from the Rogovi Foundation. Basically, it's for any documentary from around the world, but you do have to have a 501c3 status for fiscal sponsorship in the U.S.
Or you can get a fiscal sponsor. So some organizations will be fiscal sponsors for your film if you are yourself not a 501c3.
Yeah, absolutely. And the film has to either be in English or have English subtitles. But basically, it provides grants to feature-length documentary projects that address social issues and are inspiring. If you're in the advanced development stage of the doc, they award up to $10,000. And if you're in post-production or production, they award up to $25,000. So it's a pretty generous grant, and they choose up between 6 to 10 projects a year. Another one of the big documentary grants has its early deadline coming up May 16th. This is the San Francisco Film Society Documentary Film Fund. We mentioned last week that the San Francisco Film Society's San Francisco International Film Festival is going on right now. And, you know, as part of that wave, you can apply for this documentary film fund, which basically only started in 2011, but it's become one of the premier doc grants. It's also for feature-length docs like the Miller Packin Documentary Film Fund. But in this case, for the San Francisco Film Society Fund, your film has to be within 3 months of post-production or in post-production already. And they have a varying scale of awards, but last year they ranged from $15,000 to $35,000, so nothing to sneeze at. And also, if you win, you get access to a bunch of their other programs for filmmakers. And the Film Society has a whole slate of programming in this Filmmaker 360 program. So it's worth, first of all, just seeing what they have to offer and potentially becoming a member. And then if you have a film in post, going ahead and applying for this grant.
Also in the area of opportunity deadlines, festival deadlines, NoBudge.com, a film curation site run by the actor Kentucker Audley, they premiere new work every Tuesday, and they also host live screenings. So you can apply for this. The deadline to submit for that is actually tomorrow, but you can submit anytime for an online premiere. The Brooklyn event will be taking place June 27th, so if you want your short to premiere there, the deadline's coming right up, May 6th. In related news, Kentucker also has a brand, a clothing line, called Movies Brand, and on these clothing items like t-shirts, hoodies, hats, it just says Movies.
The brand is Movies.
Our own Micah Van Hove, you'll see him on some of our videos wearing it, you know, promotes movies in a semi-ironic, fashionable sense.
It's funny. It started as a Kickstarter campaign, and now it's a real brand.
It's kind of like Belushi wearing the college shirt in Animal House. Their clothing is on sale until May 12th at moviesbrand.com.
I want one. A hat.
Hook us up, Kentucker. So another deadline coming up very soon is the North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, which the acronym is NCGLFF. It is one of the largest gay, lesbian, and transgender film festivals in the southeastern United States. It takes place at the Carolina Theater in Durham, North Carolina, which also is one of the main venues of Full Frame. Great venue, downtown Durham, where I was born and raised. Great place to watch films. And given some of the topics we've talked about on this podcast in previous episodes with the state changing their non-discrimination laws, feels like an especially important event this year. So check that out. Deadline is May 6th.
For the nerds among us, the Dragon Con Independent Film Festival has a deadline May 9th. This seems like a really fun one. I've never been, but they give prizes for first place in every genre category. So they don't actually specify the categories ahead of time. It's determined based on who applies. But in the past few years, the categories have been comedy, drama, fantasy, sci-fi, thriller, horror comedy, and magical realism, for example. They also present a Best of Fest for live action and animation chosen from the first place winners of each category. And those then each have a cash prize.
Next week on May 11th, there is the Red Rock Film Festival of Zion Canyon deadline. Having spent some time in Zion Canyon myself, it is one of the most beautiful places in this country. And it is for films of all genres that portray the human race in a positive light.
There are several indies coming out on VOD this week. One is The Family Fang. This was a Tribeca favorite. I really, really wanted to see it. Folks I know who saw it loved it. It's a narrative starring Jason Bateman, Nicole Kidman, Christopher Walken. And also, Jason Bateman is the director, his first time directing. That one's coming out on the 6th, tomorrow. On the 10th, Mustang is going to hit VOD. That's directed by a name I have no idea how to say. Denise Gumze Erguven is my guess. It's a French film, although that does not sound like a French name, but worth noting that it was nominated for a foreign film Oscar out of France.
Also premiering this weekend on VOD is Michael Moore's documentary Where to Invade Next. Highly recommend this. It's not actually a documentary of invasion. It's more like him stealing the best ideas from other countries and hopefully bringing them to America. Really recommend it. It's on VOD this weekend. Coming to Amazon Prime Instant on May 9th, fittingly enough, is the Ramin Barani feature, 99 Homes. This was criminally underseen. It's a great movie, terrific performance from Michael Shannon. Andrew Garfield's also in it, very good. Laura Dern. It's a very timely and relevant story involving foreclosures. A lot of it takes place in Florida.
The Keeping Room hit Netflix on May 4th. That one's directed by Daniel Barber, notable for its strong female cast, Britt Marling, Hailee Steinfeld, Munoz Taro. It's about two sisters and one African-American slave in the South who were left without men at the end of the American Civil War and who have to defend their home from rogue soldiers who've broken off from the Union Army.
Speaking of Britt Marling and Netflix, keep your eyes out for the series. It's not out now. I'm just bringing it up because it's been much talked about. Keep your eyes out for the upcoming Netflix series, The OA, which is created by Britt Marling and Zal Batman-Zanglich, coming this year. They did Sound of My Voice and The East together. So definitely some indie heroes there. I'm curious to see what they have coming on Netflix.
Do you know anything about the series?
It's been shrouded in secrecy. Netflix has teased a lot of things. They have not shared anything about the OA. One of the interesting things to me was that Sound of My Voice, I believe that was the one it was going to be a web series. So they shot it on a Canon 7D episodically and then ended up putting it together and had the opportunity to premiere at Sundance as a feature. So in interviews talking about that, Britt and Zal have said that they had a much larger world in mind and that was a very narrow sliver of it. And I'm curious if this is similar, if it's an adaptation of that, if it's an expansion of it, if it's totally unrelated and a different idea. We'll see. We have no idea when it's coming, but sometime this year on
cool.
Netflix.
So we'll definitely keep you guys posted as we learn more. It sounds really intriguing. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, we have a new feature on the show. We've done it once before. We both really enjoyed it. We enjoy taking your questions for this segment we're calling Ask No Film School.
We've been spending some time on the boards at No Film School, and there are lots of questions there. So we've picked out a few, but you can also, of course, ask us on No Film School or on Twitter for that matter. We're easy to find. I'm at Ryan B. Koo.
And I'm at Liz Film.
And so this week, we wanted to just take a couple of discussions of note from the No Film School boards.
One of the questions on our boards came from John Stockton, who has just been in the middle of his first, directing his first film.
I'm assuming this is not the Utah Jazz basketball player.
Yeah, the Utah Jazz basketball player has been trolling our boards. He wants to be an amateur.
Might be a little bit old.
Anyway.
John, I have to apologize. I'm sure you've gotten that all of your life.
Yes, but we are validating you as the filmmaker John Stockton and not that boring old basketball guy. Anyway, so middle of his first film, frustrated as many of us have been, sort of at wit's end, feeling like he got a lot of people on board, working for free on a passion project, and then his lead actor caused some difficulty on set to the point where he's not really happy with the material that he has to work with, and he's facing post-production and going, basically, his direct question, should I finish a bad film? And we Although these questions are out there in part for us to answer on air, I have to say that this was one of the most thoughtful series of responses that I've seen out there. You know, a lot of times internet commenters can get kind of hatey, as we all know, and we've even discussed on this show. But in this case, people gave John some really nice advice and a lot of encouragement about basically, yes, you should. And yeah, Ryan, I wanted to add to that a little bit.
Well, I think we can all identify with that. I mean, that's the stuff of nightmares, because movies can be ruined in any number of ways. And sometimes it's death by a thousand cuts, and it's lots of small decisions. And other times it's one person. And in this case, it seems like his actor wasn't giving him what he wanted. Liz, so what do you think? Should he finish it?
Look, it's a really tricky question, and I can really feel his pain, even in his responses to other people's responses, saying, like, I should finish it because so many people care, but, you know, I'm not going to make what I thought I was going to make. And I have to say, as a doc person, this really resonated with me, because actually, John, you know, that's what we doc filmmakers deal with all the time. We go in there thinking we're going to make one thing, and we shoot all this footage, and suddenly, you know, life happens, and it's never the film we thought that we were going to make. And that can be frustrating and sort of painful. But ultimately, you know, at least in the doc world, it often ends up that the film you end up making is much better than what you ever could have imagined from the beginning. And so I guess, although it's not the typical narrative way, I encourage you to try to think like a documentary filmmaker, and maybe even bring a documentary filmmaker into your post-production process, or work with a kind of a story producer who's used to shaping material, and try to look at your material in a different way and see if somehow you could end up with a different and even better finished product than you had in your script.
Absolutely. Absolutely finish it. I mean, that's how you learn things. If it turns out terribly, you might learn more than if it turned out well. Finishing it doesn't necessarily mean that when you've gotten it as far as you can go, when you've approached it from all of the different angles and thought about what kind of changes you can make, and maybe there's a different narrative device, whether that's flashback or voiceover, like really try to think about all the different things you can do to make the best version of the film that you can, given what you have. Whether or not you release it is probably a question of where your financing came from, if you have investors, if something has been promised contractually. But it makes me think back to when I had the opportunity to have Doug Lyman as my mentor at a Film Society of Lincoln Center program. And Doug, who got his start for directing Swingers and has gone on to do The Bourne Identity and Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Edge of Tomorrow, just massive, massive films. Everyone thinks that Swingers was his first movie. It wasn't. He did a movie that really didn't turn out well, and it got shelved and no one ever saw it. And the things that he learned from that led to him wanting to make Swingers. And that was how he approached Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn, because this first movie he had made, he said it was completely useless, all of it except for the title sequence was something he did at the end just in his basement by himself. And he learned from that that he could do it with just a camera and shoot it himself. And so that's why when he went to make Swingers, he was also the DP on that. He knew how little he needed and how fast he wanted to move. And the experience of having made this bad movie that no one ever saw is what allowed him to make the thing that broke his career.
I love that.
Also on the No Film School boards, Mervyn Jones asked, when filming a black and white film, is it better to shoot in color and fix it in post? So one of the things that's wonderful now about cinematography is that several manufacturers have monochrome cameras. Typically, a digital camera these days goes through a process called debayering, where you're taking the information and extracting color, essentially. Someone can explain that better than my writer-director self, a cinematographer, for example, or a DIT. But essentially, you're not getting full resolution, and by designing a camera for monochrome and removing the IR filter, you can get a better, pure grayscale image out of these monochrome cameras. Red makes one, Arri makes one. So potentially, to have the highest quality image, you could have a dedicated digital camera, which is different from years past where you would almost, the only video cameras were color and then you'd desaturate it in post. The challenge in going with that is when you are shooting in color, you could potentially just set your monitors to monochrome, and you could gain flexibility in terms of when you're extracting the, when you're transitioning an image to black and white, you can use different colors and process them differently. If anyone's poked around in Lightroom or Photoshop, they have black and white filters where you're using the reds and the yellows and the greens differently, which can create some different looks that you might want to use. And you lose that if you shoot in monochrome. The major issue to me, because I would want to use the monochrome camera because it has higher dynamic range, higher resolution. There's some really brilliant images out there, and I hope to shoot a feature on one of them. Not my feature, but a forthcoming feature. This my basketball movie is Color. One of the challenges, though, is if you want to do visual effects, you can't do things like chroma keying because there's no color info in there to begin with. So I think the question often depends on the project you're making and whether you have visual effects or keying, the kinds of things that you, if you're just extracting all the color info at the beginning, you don't have any of it, then you will lose those things.
I think that about covers the technical spectrum of the question, but I would just, you know, throw in there from an artistic perspective that regardless of which technology you choose to shoot the film, I would definitely think carefully about that choice in general to shoot in black and white. Or to, you know, do a film in black and white, however you end up creating it. It's such a strong choice. And, you know, as we've said on this show many, many times before, the story really has to lead. So, you know, try to avoid relying on a device like black and white to make a certain kind of point. Make sure that the story itself is strong enough to make whatever point, no matter kind of what visual devices you're using.
The other thing about it, too, to keep in mind there is that that choice you make, there have been some films in the past that the director originally intended to release in black and white, and the studio or the distributor decided that it wouldn't be commercial, and then they wanted a color version, and they released it in color. So maybe if your film turns out a certain way, and someone's interested in acquiring it and distributing it, if they want to turn it into color, it's then a separate decision for you if that's a compromise you're willing to make. If you do want more people to see the movie, so on and so forth. At least you're protecting yourself if you've done it in color. But that may also be sacrificing your creative intent.
Right. It's a risky choice, but hey, you know, we love risk.
As always, you can find links to the stories we talk about, the grant deadlines we mention, on the Associated Post at nofilmschool.com. Please subscribe to the show in your favorite podcasting app. Rate us in iTunes, por favor. And Indie Film Weekly, as always, is produced and edited by John Fusco. Thanks for listening.
See you next week.